Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 20.
Altitude.
Tower 20 is released to you, runway 411040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
Viper Jack 2. Viper Jack 2. Viper Jack 2. Viper Jack 2.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
Turn in, lights on.
During that mission. So I'm testing the AIM-120D and I'm doing the high Mach run. So the plan is to go as fast as I can, no more than 2.5 Mach, initially we took 6 AMRAMs with us because the test did not call for 8 AMRAMs. That's how many we can take. So we took 6 with us because it didn't say that we needed 8 and the engineers thought it'd be fine. And so I took 6, which meant on one of my sides, I was missing 2 AMRAMs. So I was heavier on one side. And by the way, getting to Mach 2.5 in any aircraft is difficult. Well, you know, in these fighter aircraft is difficult. So trying to get to that speed required me to basically be on the tanker, fully load up on gas, detach, and immediately go into afterburner, climb up to 38,000, 39,000 feet.
Today's guest is Air Force Colonel Tucker Cinco Hamilton. He's an F-35 test pilot, and he's the current director of the Air Force's Artificial Intelligence Accelerator at MIT. In that clip, he's talking about doing a weapons test in the F-15, going 20-plus miles a minute, maximum performing aircraft, so it can get kind of sporty. We talk about his aviation career and a lot more in today's episode. I would like to thank all those who are supporting the podcast via Patreon, going to iTunes, hitting subscribe, leaving a rating review. It's definitely helping the podcast grow. So I appreciate it. If you are enjoying it and haven't done so, please swing over to iTunes, leave me a rating or review. Again, it's something small and simple, but it does make a big difference for me and the podcast and keeping this going. So thanks for all those who've done it. And again, if you haven't, please consider taking the time just to swing over there and hit a few buttons. And I also like to thank Wingman Watch for sponsoring this episode. Again, I love working with these guys, veteran-owned, founded by a fire pilot. If you're looking to build a custom watch for your group, your organization, swing over to wingmanwatch.com. It's super easy. Start to finish, they take care of it all. It's free to start. Wingmanwatch.com. Again, you won't be disappointed. If you see a watch on there you already like, you can use the code RAIN10 and receive 10% off. Just mention my name for your group customization order, and you'll get a discount on that too. All right, with that being said, let's roll into the podcast with Colonel Tucker Cinco Hamilton. Sir, thanks for joining me on the podcast. If you would mind, just give everyone just a little 30-second elevator pitch of who you are, where you've been, and kind of what you're doing today, and then we'll dive into your aviation career.
Yeah, Rain, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be able to speak with you and share with your listeners, you know, some of my experiences, as biased as they are. I am a test pilot for the Air Force. So I've been flying aircraft, which was a surprise to me. It's kind of a surprise for me to even say that because it was never my plan. But I've been flying for the Air Force since 2002. And I've had a very fortunate career flying lots of different aircraft. Went to test pilot school, tested F-15Cs and E's, been working on programmatics for the F-35, and then after that, I was director of operations and then the commander of F-35 development, which was an amazing experience. And then I found myself here at MIT, and I'm the director of the Department of the Air Force and MIT Artificial Intelligence Accelerator, where we're trying to bring AI into the department. And it's been fascinating. And once again, not something that I necessarily planned, but I've loved the journey so far. So I'd love to share some stories about how I got here and my perspectives.
Well, Colonel Hamilton, again, thanks for joining me. I would like to kind of dive in to where it all started, or at least where I kind of found you. It was Instagram, right? So you share a lot of videos on Instagram of the F-35 in particular in the test. So being a test pilot, can you kind of talk to me about the process? Just rudimentary, how did you become a test pilot and what does that process look like?
Yeah, I've loved being a test pilot. It has suited me very well, but it's kind of a marriage between aviation and engineering. Though I would say I don't do too much engineering as a test pilot. I need to understand what the engineers are saying. That's where the engineering degree comes in handy and is really a must have. So I became a test pilot after being an operational pilot for so long. Basically, you have to have so many hours to apply to test pilot school. So you can't even really apply until around 7-8 years in your career. You have about a 2 or 3 year window where you have the hours to apply, and then you're young enough to apply. So there's a very small window. They have about 80 fighter pilots apply every year for about 10 slots. So it's fairly competitive. You need to have a STEM background in order to do that. And I studied aerospace engineering at the University of Colorado. So I had that STEM background. I also knew that a master's degree would help me be competitive. So I received a master's degree in aerospace engineering from the University of Tennessee while I was on active duty, which was extremely difficult going to classes in my first fighter squadron in aerospace. And then got that degree. And they want to see pilots that have experienced different airframes. So I was an F-15C pilot, but then I was initial cadre for the MC-12, which is an intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance aircraft that was stood up in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so it was me and 10 other people. It was fantastic, amazing experiences that I'm happy to share some stories with you there. But, did that in combat and had that kind of experience with multiple airframes. And then you apply, have an opportunity to go out there and interview then. It's a flying interview where they throw you in an aircraft that you're quote unquote unfamiliar with without basically any information. And they ask you to do certain things in those aircraft. They grade you. And it just so happened that I did well enough that I got selected to attend the United States Air Force Test Pilot School Class 11 Bravo. So I began that journey in 2011, and it's a year-long master's degree in flight test engineering where you fly like 30 different aircraft, just a fantastic aviation experience, probably the best aviation experience in the world. And while you're going through that, you're also taking engineering classes and writing, 40-something reports. It is an intense academic year with a lot of aviation. And you're just learning basically how to be the first person to do something in an aircraft. So they want to give us wide ranging experiences so that when we find ourselves in an aircraft doing something for the first time, that we have kind of a toolkit to lean back on of experiences of doing the unknown through test pilot school, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And to me, that's fascinating, obviously, because you're flying so many different airplanes and you're not getting the depth that we're used to when we go through Air Force training for a different weapon system. So if you're going to go fly airplane X, Y, or Z in test pilot school, how much like prep time, if you're going to go fly the T-38 or the F-16 and you've never done that and you get thrown into it, what is that? Is that like a week lead into it? Is it the night before you get tagged with it? How does that work?
Yeah, so some of the aircraft we fly during test pilot school, we get qualified to fly. We don't go through a check ride, but so the C-12, the T-38, and the F-16, we actually get flight hours in with instructors, and we oftentimes get cleared solo. So I could fly myself and a crew member in a C-12, I could fly crew solo in a T-38, and I flew solo in an F-16 as well. I have 1 hour in an F-16C.
Nice.
Most of our solo time, quote unquote, is actually us solo with a flight test engineer with us that is also a student. So that's when we're cleared solo in those three aircraft. The other aircraft we fly, which is around 27, It really depends. Sometimes you get more prep time. Gliders, we flew more often, some of the gliders, so you had experience to lean back on. In other planes, you had basically like 1 or 2 days. And what they're trying to teach you is, what do you need to know in order to be safe and successful on your mission? So for instance, the A-10 is probably the best experience. I loved it. You show up on a Monday morning, you go through a day of academics. The next day you go through 2 or 3 sims, and the next day you go out fully loaded in a single seat A-10, because there are no two seat A-10s. Well, there are 2 of them that have been retired from long ago. So you go out in a single seat A-10 with a fully loaded gun and bombs, and you go out to the range with an instructor pilot on your wing, and you do that after 2 days of training. And it typically takes, I think, Air Force pilots going through the A-10 pipeline weeks and weeks to be able to actually fly on top of going out to the range and shooting the gun. So once it depends, but they really want to make you feel uncomfortable, yet learn how to be safe in those situations.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. What was the most challenging aspect of going through test pilot school?
I think it was learning the flight dynamics of the different aircraft and how the different, like, equations of freedom, equations of motion, pardon me, the 6 degrees of freedom, equations of motion, all, like all that, how they come together, and how you sitting in the cockpit flying a maneuver can now visualize in your brain how the different aerodynamics are playing on the system, and that how you are interacting human factors wise with that system. So like handling qualities is the way that the pilot handles the aircraft, which is totally different than flying qualities, which is the way the aerodynamics are affecting the flight controls and the flight systems and how those interface. So it just the exercise every day of trying to connect like all of this very deep academic knowledge into the aviation experience of flying a maneuver. Right. So I'm rolling right, but what is really going on? And of course, people think, well, the ailerons are moving and the stabs. Yes, but there's more to it, right? There's something deeper. And then how does that input to roll right actually go into the computer? And what are the biases that I'm bringing to this maneuver that I need to watch out for so that I can help other pilots overcome certain challenges that they may have when they're flying a system that I'm testing?
Incredibly complex stuff. Like I'm used to just, I'm going to pull as hard as I can, right? Until the plane can't give me any more. What were there any times that you were like painted into a corner? Or do you find yourself like, I wish I didn't do that, going through TPS and then like initially as a test pilot? Cause I would like to talk about developmental tests versus operational tests and kind of what the differences is. Like what is developmental test? Cause that's where you found yourself after TPS, correct?
Yeah, no, it's good. So let me answer that first, the difference between operational tests, what we call OT, and developmental tests, what we call DT, and then talk about some corners that I may have painted myself into. So developmental test is developing a system or an aircraft. Developmental test pilots go through test pilot school, and we are the first ones to touch a system. Maybe it's a weapon, maybe it's a radar or sensor, maybe it's the aircraft itself. So the first people to fly it, to evaluate it, to make sure that it's safe, to make sure that it meets contractual obligations that were put out in the acquisition process. And we're the ones to kind of first do that. Operational test, I think of them as the like tactical experts. So they're the ones that are extremely competent, credible at tactically flying the airframe. Now, to be a developmental test pilot, you have to be able to do that, right? But an operational test pilot, those are the guys that are the tactician, they're the experts, and they're going to take the aircraft once it's safe to fly, once some basic contractual obligations have been met, proven through DT, they're going to take, as operational test pilots, the plane, and they're going to wring it out, and they're going to put it in simulated combat environments, and they're going to see if the system works, not the way the contract says that it should work, that's my job as a DT pilot, but if it works the way that they need it to work for the warfighter. And so they're the ones that take an airframe like the F-35 and they develop the tactics on like, how are we going to employ the F-35? I'm the pilot before any of that happened that made sure the F-35 could go fly at 1.6 Mach, that could go pull 9 Gs if needed, that the radar worked, that the weapon actually hit the target that it was supposed to, and they're going to take it and develop the tactic around it. So that's the difference between OT and DT. Yes, as a DT pilot, especially as a DT pilot in the F-15, which is a very proven F-15C and F-15E, very proven airframes. They've been around for decades. Some of them are older than me. and there's not much to rediscover, but our primary job in those planes is to ensure that radar upgrades, software upgrades, weapon upgrades, that they all are safe. And the weapon stuff is probably the most exciting things we would do. So if there's a new weapon, for instance, I was flying around an AMRAAM, an AIM-120D now. So AIM-120D, it's the next generation of AMRAAM that we're flying with it now. But when I was testing it back in 2012, it wasn't distributed yet. Or it had just been, but we were still doing some initial testing on it. So I had to take that aircraft and go do what we call a compatibility flight profile on it. So I basically needed to go and make sure the thing didn't fall off the aircraft and then make sure that I basically like turned the hell out of that thing, pulling as many G's as I could, going as fast as I could, going as low as I could, going slow, doing everything I could in the entire flight envelope to make sure that that system didn't fall off and that it was ready to be safely separated from the aircraft. So there's different types of weapons testing we did, but this one, compatibility flight profile, is the, like putting it through the ringer of the entire flight envelope. And that was an amazing experience where I basically took fully loaded F-15C. I think it was an F-15D actually, you know, the two seat, which we did a lot of our testing in because we had flight test engineers in our backseat. But we actually didn't let a flight test engineer fly with me on this one because it was too high risk. So we would go out fully loaded 8 AMRAAMs, and we needed to go out the door and go to Mach 2, really 2.5, or get as fast as we could. We figured there were going to be some problems getting to 2.5. We needed to go as low and fast as we could, which was actually way more dangerous, going 800 kcas at, you know, 2,000 feet fully loaded. We had to go to 1.5 Mach and do full stick rolls at 7.2 Gs. So pulling 7.2 Gs with a complete and immediate step input of full side stick to make sure that the aircraft, once again, was, that's a part of its envelope that it's supposed to be able to do, that this missile worked the way that it was supposed to. So it's not just that it falls off. I mean, I'm being dramatic when I say make sure it doesn't fall off. Like, we literally are making sure it doesn't fall off, but we're also connected in with the weapon and making sure that it's not overheating or it's not having any vibrational issues and that it still works at the end of that mission. So I can get into more details of that, but that is like some of the stuff that we, that I was able to go fly.
Yeah, I cringed during some of that story there, just like thinking about going those speeds, obviously loaded out and like full inputs. And I mean, you're straining things, but there's so many things that are going on that could go wrong. And these are really precise weapons. So it's pretty phenomenal. That's why I think it's like fascinating. You've shared some videos on Instagram, which, you know, doing flight tests with weapons that don't act the way they're supposed to. So people can go check those out, which I think are pretty interesting. Side note, I did get to shoot a 120D, which is pretty cool. Right time, right place test. But, you know, it's the advent of all the DT going through, making sure that everything works, which is pretty cool. Were there any times doing tests like that you found yourself in a spot where you said, I don't want to be here right now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. During that mission. So I'm testing the AIM-120D and I'm doing the high Mach run. So the plan is to go as fast as I can, no more than 2.5 Mach, which... Initially, we took 6 AMRAAMs with us because the test did not call for 8 AMRAAMs. That's how many we can take. So we took 6 with us because it didn't say that we needed 8 and the engineers thought it'd be fine. And so I took 6, which meant on one of my sides, I was missing 2 AMRAAMs. So I was heavier on one side. And by the way, getting to Mach 2.5 in any aircraft is difficult. Well, you know, in these fighter aircraft, it's difficult.
Yep.
So trying to get to that speed required me to basically be on the tanker, fully load up on gas, detach, and immediately go into afterburner, climb up to 38,000, 39,000 feet at 0.9 Mach, accelerate out to like 1.1 Mach, climb up to 42,000 feet at 1.1 Mach, descend down to 34,000 feet getting around 1.5 Mach, climbing up to 48,000 feet and back down, and then back up again to 50,000 feet, which is our ceiling. And then at 1.8 Mach at 50,000 feet, start a nice and easy descent, looking for the temperature that is going to allow me to accelerate more, most effectively. Because you can't, what people would think is that you just, okay, you're at 50,000 feet, you're 1.8 Mach, I'm going to go 30 degrees nose low, and I'm going to get to 2.5 Mach. Like, absolutely not. It doesn't work that way. So I'm at 50,000 feet. I'm starting to descend at 1.8 Mach, and I'm looking for that sweet air to continue my acceleration out to pass two. And at 1.87 Mach, I distinctly remember my nose started hunting. So I started questioning the directional stability of the aircraft, once again, leaning back on my developmental test pilot experience through test pilot school, where the nose starts, it's a feeling of like being on ice skates, where you feel like the nose starts kind of moving back and forth, left and right, a little too loosely. And it started feeling uncomfortable. And as you accelerate, of course, you're going to have other issues if you have directional instability issue, you know, problems. So my nose starts hunting back and forth. And at the same time, I get a bleed air light, which is one of the like the most pressing emergencies in an F-15. A bleed air light is saying like, hey, there is a bleed air leak going on, and bleed air is coming off the engine at super hot, like over 1,000 degrees. It's basically a blowtorch, and it is a major issue to have a bleed air light. And so I find myself at 1.87 Mach with some directional stability concerns while I have this bleed air emergency at 50,000 feet. I'm like, all right, so I got to slow down. And guess what? You can't just slow down when you're going that fast, because if you just rip the throttles to idle and they let you take it to idle, you'd blow out both your engines right away. You'd compressor stall both of them. So we have something called idle cutoff. Basically, I throw the engines to idle, but the engine knows like, hey, dummy, I'm not actually going to go to idle. And at certain speeds, it takes you to certain settings. So when you're going as fast as I'm going and I go to idle, it actually just takes me to mil power. It takes me out of AB, which, by the way, is still going super fast. So now I'm trying to slow down. I start with the directional stability. I start trying to put G's on the aircraft, but it just so happens in the F-15, at certain airspeeds, actually it accelerates faster at 2 G's than it does at 1 G. So now I start pulling G's, but now I start kind of accelerating more because it's trying to, so at the same time, I'm supposed to like, you know, turn off my, I'm forgetting all the, yeah, it's been a while since I flew the F-15, but I have to turn off my air to the bleed system so that this torch that could be going on back there is, it, you know, has this air cut off, which also decompresses the cockpit. And so like all these things are going on at once. It's an extremely intense situation. This is why we have flight control. This is why we have control rooms and flight test engineers and other people supporting us on the ground. And it's an amazing team sport flight test. So we finally, I'm able to slow down. It took me forever because the engines didn't want to slow down. So I started bringing more G's on the aircraft, being careful with directional instability that I was feeling. And we were able to slow down. And then I declared an emergency and returned home right away. It turns out that the bleed air was just a bad sensor. So I didn't have a bleed air leak. I didn't know that at the time, of course.
Right.
So it's situations like that, that I've definitely felt very uncomfortable trying to figure out everything that's going wrong and not overreacting in certain situations that could make things worse for me. Now I go back up and I basically told them we couldn't fly that mission again with 6 missiles. That the directional instability was too much of a concern. So they made it symmetric, gave me 8 missiles. And then we were able to go out a few days later and successfully do the entire mission. But that's one story of being painted, I guess, into a corner, flying high and fast.
You know, so the Dash 2, for those who don't know, that is all the limits and the different configurations that we look at. For me, as a simpleton, you know, it's a spaghetti chart. I mean, it's for the F-16, I mean, it's probably 800 pages of just different configurations. I assume the F-15 probably similar along those lines. One thing I've always been curious about is going out fully loaded, and this, your story has spurred that, right? If we go out 6x0 and shoot 4 missiles, you know, we're typically still doing the same tactics. You know, that's all we ever talked about, same tactics and flows and getting fast. But there are sub notes, right? In the dash two, or it's talking as the configuration changes. And that would be one of those scenarios. If you went out 8x0 in the Eagle, then only shot two, you could find yourself in that situation, right?
Yeah, we were actually a part of writing those notes, right? So that's kind of our job, is to communicate that. Now, I will say, like, the Eagle is stable. I think that there's some stability concerns, depending on your asymmetric situation. The truth is, though, no one's going out. I mean, it's so rare to go those speeds anyway.
Right. It'd be super rare, like, yeah, end of the world type scenario. Yeah.
Like, it could happen, of course, but just going that fast for any aircraft, you're using so much fuel that it isn't usually advisable.
Right.
Yes, but you have to be, as a pilot, you need to be aware of those notes, and the notes would probably say, hey, you know, be careful for directional stability if you have, you know, an asymmetric AMRAAM loadout.
Yeah. I'm curious too. So you've worked several programs, and I know it probably depends. AIM-120D is probably one of those programs. Small diameter bomb, I think the second version as well. What does it look like kind of start to finish? Like, how much planning and detail? Because, like, hey, we want to buy bomb X or missile Y. It's not just that simple. It's a long, obviously, procurement process. But when it shows up to developmental test, how long does that take? What does that process look like?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. A lot of these weapon systems, as you rightly said, it takes years to procure them, get them on contract. The test pilot community, the test professional community, they get involved fairly soon. For starters, a lot of the acquisition program offices have individuals that have been through test pilot school, right? So flight test engineers and or pilots. So from the beginning, they have a perspective of what is going to be needed in order to validate, verify. So you get it, though, after however long that lead turn is, and you work with the team before it really shows up. You work with the team on what test points do you need to go prove that this is safe and that it meets the contractual specifications. I've been a part of some programs. We were supporting I won't mention the country. We were supporting a country who's you know, an ally of ours, and they wanted to test something on the F-15. And so what we did is we were given so much money. We were given a schedule, what we call cost schedule performance. You know, so we're managing cost schedule performance of this, and we need to go make sure that this weapon that they wanted us to test was going to work the way that it was supposed to. And so, you know, for that, we wanted to do a 15 flight program. We wanted to do a compatibility flight profile to make sure that it didn't fall off the aircraft. We wanted to do a safe separation. So we wanted to make sure that it safely separates from the aircraft. Safe separation is important, is extremely important. And it basically is separating the weapon, either firing a missile or dropping a bomb, at the kind of the extreme envelope of that weapon. So a GBU-12, I had to go do a safe separation of a GBU-12 and an F-35. And it was only a 5G or something like that. I forget all that. But, you know, it was a few Gs, basically, of this is how the weapon could possibly be used. For a missile, it's usually going to the corner of the envelope. So, hey, 9G pull, we need you to fire this missile and just make sure that separates. But you build up to that. So it takes a number of flights. And then you're going to go out the door and you're going to do weapons accuracy testing, which is making sure that the system hits the target that it's supposed to hit, which is totally different than safe separation, because now you're bringing in the actual mission systems of the platform. So we wanted to do like 15 flights. And the program office, the people involved were like, listen, you have three flights to completely shoot down a full-scale F-4 drone off your nose by 1 mile at the extreme. So over 7.5 Gs, go in, you know, Mach whatever, I won't say the numbers. Yeah. And you basically have one flight to make sure it doesn't fall off the aircraft, one flight to make sure the system is working correctly, and you have one missile, one shot, go to the corner of the envelope. Now, there's sometimes where you push back. And that's our job, responsibility, to say that's not enough. But we were able to mitigate the risk enough where we feel comfortable and we could go do that. So like in that instance, it was you have the weapon for, you know, 2 months, and then you write the report and give your engineering recommendation.
what was your transition like? Because from running F-15, doing F-15 test into the F-35, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I had a great lead into it because I was the developmental test lead for the F-35 program at the program office for 2 years before I started flying the F-35. So I was extremely familiar with the programmatics behind the platform. I understood what all the test sites were doing. I managed flight tests at both Pax River, which is F-35B and F-35C flight science testing, as well as aircraft carrier suitability testing. And I managed all the flight operations at Edwards Air Force Base, which was F-35A flight science testing, and F-35A, F-35B, and F-35C mission systems testing. So we were responsible for doing all the mission systems of the F-35. So when I jumped into the platform, I knew the problems that we were facing. I will say it was amazing to get in an aircraft that is new, flying the F-15C and even the F-15E, which was still a few decades old, to something that new car smell, yeah. And it was great. The technology was amazing, though we were having some major problems in the F-35 program. As everyone knows, it was politically charged, of course. When I was in the program office, we had to deal with a lot of inquiries and frustrations with kind of misrepresentation of how the aircraft was doing, which was frustrating to deal with. Like, there was a dogfight that it wasn't a dogfight, but it got misconstrued as a dogfight, and the F-35 was being outperformed by an F-16. And it wasn't the test, that wasn't what they were doing. They weren't, the whole story wasn't out there. So we dealt with that nonstop. And then jumping into the platform and really seeing the struggles that we were having. The F-35, I wasn't a believer, man. Really? I gotta be honest. And I've said this to many news outlets when I was the commander of F-35. Yeah. I'm a total believer now, but I was not a believer because it just was not performing. Getting the aircraft started took forever, right? It's like restarting your computer. You'd have to reset it, yeah, because the systems weren't starting up correctly. And they had a major stability issues. The thing is, it's all fusion based. And so for the listeners that don't understand fusion, all the sensors are fused together, working together in order to give the operator the picture that they need in order to employ on the battlefield. The problem with fusion is you don't really know what's wrong sometimes, because if you can't see the target at 40 nautical miles, is it the radar that can't see the target, or is it the IR sensor that is actually taking a piece of data and inputting it wrong into the fusion engine, which is now impacting the radar? And now you could say the same thing for data links and MADL, which is our own onboard link between F-35s. So it's just very complicated and intricate. And because of that, the system wasn't stable. Like, a radar would shut down and the whole system would shut down while we're flying. And you're like, well, I can't do this test now because F-35's not working. We went out, and something the F-35 does very well now is called enhanced geolocation, or EGL. It's the kind of the SEAD mission. So if suppression of enemy air defenses, if people don't know, and you're basically trying to find surface to air missile threats, they're going to attack you. And the F-35 is supposed to be really good at this. And we were scratching our heads because it just wasn't working. I remember the first tape, I was flying in the formation. It was all right, this doesn't work. These buttons aren't working. This thing's not working, and all the data. And so the engineers were trying to figure out what was going on. And this is kind of my first few months in the program, flying in the jet. And so I wasn't a believer. And then what happened is they figured out the stability of the system, so that it wasn't shutting down and it was starting up correctly. And once they figured that out, they went to town on getting the capability where it needed to. So I'll tell you, man, it was just crazy night and day. November, October, whatever, a few years ago, I think it was 2016, the system wasn't working at all. Fast forward a year, and we were doing 10 ship operations with amazing EGL quality, being able to do the entire suppression of enemy air defense mission set with no real hiccups in the system. And then this is around the same time people are going to red flag. There's some red flags where we did 2B software, and 2B doesn't have EGL and a lot of the mission system stuff, which is an older kind of software suite. And so now we're flying with 3F at this point, and the system was cooking along, and it really was awesome to see that entire team, all the way from Lockheed Martin to the program office to our team to Pax River, really see that jet come full circle in a very short period of time once they figured out that the software stability problem.
Yeah. Do you think it was just the Air Force doing a bad job at press and telling the story of the F-35 initially, or is it just some naysay? I mean, you guys answered a lot of those questions. I know that like the standard, you can't replace the A-10, right? But that the F-35 is not meant to replace the A-10. Like it's solving more complex problems.
Yes, dude. Yeah. I don't know. The answer to your initial question is, did the Air Force do a poor job? I don't know. I think that there was a lot going against the F-35. I think that people don't understand how complicated this system really is and how difficult it is to create this machinery that is really changing the battlefield. Even when they initially thought of some of the capability the F-35 was going to have, they didn't know how they were going to get there when they initially came up with it, right? So it's just a long process. And I think that that's some of the difficulties when you have a long process. I think that they had some programmatic issues in the way they acquired it. I think there are some problems with concurrency, which is doing OT and DT at the same time, though we made the best of it. I think there are problems too with the way that we were managing the program back in the late 2009, 2010 timeframe. And there was a non-McCurdy, which people won't understand, but it's like an acquisition issue. Basically, we're going way over budget. And so they rearranged the way that we were going to manage programmatics, which helped a lot. So we weren't helping ourselves out initially. On top of it, it was a very complicated problem. And then because of that, we were having bad press. People were looking basically for blood in the water. And they would, you know, they would take stories like this whole A-10 thing or the dogfighting thing, and they would blow it out of proportion and make everyone's, you know, job more difficult. And I don't want to throw the media under the bus, like, not at all, man. I think that's important, right? It's a right to make sure that we're held accountable, that we're transparent. But it was challenging because I feel at times people didn't understand. And the whole A-10 thing, man, I love the A-10. The A-10 can never be beat on the battlefield regarding close air support, you know, maybe a gunship, right? But you're basically like just phenomenal at what you're doing. But that, exactly what you said, the F-35 was never meant to be that support system, right? It's meant to be the fifth gen fighter that can go into a contested environment and still get the job done, even though it won't do it the same way that the A-10 does it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'd like to transition a little bit about what you're doing now. So can you tell the listeners what your current role is and what a day in the life looks like?
Artificial intelligence has been around for decades, right? It's now becoming this big buzzword and people are trying to understand it more because we got to a point where we basically had the computing power on top of the data that allowed machine learning and artificial intelligence, by the way, machine learning is artificial intelligence, is a subset of it, allowed machine learning to be effective, right? And so over the past decade, we've really recognized that we're able to use like artificial intelligence, machine learning to solve some of our problems. But the challenge is a lot of people are uneducated regarding AI, machine learning. They don't understand like really what we're going after because they just, they conjure up images of, you know, what is it, like Robot Eye or, you know, the AI movie or Skynet. Yeah. They just don't understand like, no, AI is just a part of, you know, systems, basically. It powers systems to allow them to be more effective and to work better with the operator, right? So our job up here at MIT is to basically work with MIT in solving Air Force problems using artificial intelligence. And it's all unclassified work. Like MIT is an academic institution. They're very concerned about making sure that we're doing something for society, that we're not trying to weaponize anything. And like that, absolutely, like there's no part of what we're doing that's weaponizing AI. Like that is some conversations that I'm sure other people are having, but we are working on like 10 unclassified projects to just make AI real for our airmen and our space professionals out there. And so we have 10 projects. They kind of run the gamut. One's R2-D2 in the cockpit, helping a pilot understand, you know, like if they're on a wrong route or if they are getting too low on gas and like getting their attention, think R2-D2. Like that's kind of the name we've given it, R2-D2 in the cockpit. Another one is helping pilots at pilot training maximize their effectiveness by monitoring how they're doing, seeing where they're maybe they're looking their eye, where they are focused their attention on, and then giving that information to instructors while they're in a sim, right? So as a sim instructor, and you've been instructor at a pilot training base, I believe, right?
Yep.
And if you knew though, like, hey, your pilot that you're monitoring now in the sim is spending 90% of their time looking at their attitude and, you know, no time looking at their airspeed, you can know right then if you've kind of tapped them out, right? So it's a way for us to measure cognitive performance and to feed that back to instructors to help them better instruct the student that is, you know, that is going through a sim mission or a flight mission one day. You know, we have other ones where we're working on weather and trying to better forecast, predict weather using the different systems that the that are at our disposal. Other projects are small UAS, like imagine a disaster, a hurricane that comes in, and you want small UASs to go out and you want them to find survivors, people that are maybe stuck in debris that need help, so you can focus the first responders to those areas. Well, what we're doing is we're trying to figure out how to train these autonomous small UASs to be able to go do that, right? Because you can't just drop an autonomous drone into a hurricane ravaged city and think it's going to go out and figure out like where everything is and where the survivors are. So it needs to actually be trained effectively. So we're actually, our program is working on training these drones to be able to go out and autonomously help, you know, survivors. And the list goes on. And we're also working on trying to educate the Air Force and the Space Force on what AI is. So we have a number of efforts along those lines. There are 11 active duty officers, 11 active duty Air Force members here, 9 officers and 2 enlisted. And they are integrated with the project teams on MIT side. And we also work with Lincoln Labs. So it's kind of us trying to break down barriers and integrate with work with our academic partners in order to, you know, bring to bear AI.
So bringing that to bear, what does that process look like? Are any of these, do you think anything will actually make it? So for instance, the pilot training simulator and monitoring students, how does that go from concept to development to actually executing and using it?
Yeah, one of the challenges we have in the acquisition world is trying to figure out how to integrate technology like this. And AI, because it could be useful in a lot of scenarios. You know, how do you integrate it into systems that are already out there? How do you develop systems that have it? How do you test those systems? How do you make sure it's ethical the way that you're presenting? And that's an imperative for us is, you know, ethical implementation of AI. But ultimately, we partnered with program offices from the inception of each of our projects. So they're involved with our weekly meetings, they're involved with our the progress of some of this technology. And as we go towards some of these big goals, like this whole idea of R2-D2 in the cockpit, dude, that is a enormous ask, right? It's a huge goal that's gonna take years to possibly get there. But what our team is able to do, because we have airmen here embedded, is they're able to see where we could take some of the technology that's being developed and spin it off using Lincoln Labs and program offices to figure out like, oh, we could use this algorithm in these scenarios too to help, you know, whatever situation is going on out there. So for instance, one of our projects is called Puckboard, and it is, you know, you can imagine scheduling in a fighter squadron or, you know, a heavy squadron is very complicated. We have all these different computer programs. We usually rely on puck boards. So they're like magnetic boards with people's names on them. And then the scheduler just kind of throws up different names. And so what we're trying to do is power a lot of the systems that are out there with AI on the back end so that they can be useful, more useful for the operators and more interactive. So like having an app on your phone where you could put in a few things and then AI comes a part of that and can help the scheduler make the best decisions quickly on like who should be scheduled for certain missions. And why I told you that whole thing about Puckboard is because we are right now, we're actually transitioning that technology. So we're able to work with those program offices and operators. So it's in C-17 squadrons. It's a part of their scheduling software that they use. And it's baby steps right now. Just a few factors are going into that AI-powered aspect of the system. But we are able to transition some of those capabilities right now. So that's one of them. We have a few others that we're working to transition. And other than that, we're doing basic research here and looking for opportunities to help our airmen and space professionals out there that need or that have problems that could be crushed with AI.
I think if you solve squadron scheduling, you've solved all the world's problems. Like you guys can pack it up and head home.
Yeah. I think we're realizing that the fighter, like what we've worked so far is hopefully going to be a back end for fighter squadrons, but it's not as useful right now in its current state. It's great for C-17 squadrons, and that's what our customer, that's what we're working for. But yeah, the fighter squadron scheduling is still, we're still a little bit away from that.
It's 20, 30 years down the road. I know, so obviously in your current capacity and not weaponizing and things of that nature, there's a clear delineation there. What do you think the future of AI and what that's going to have in the battle space and how that's going to shape the future for wars?
I definitely think that it is going to shape our societies tremendously. It already is. People, I think, are starting to realize that as you wake up in the morning and ask, you know, Siri or Alexa what the weather is, right? That's all AI. It's natural language processing AI. And it is becoming a part of everything that that we're interacting with, our weather forecasts and our social media, our the people, how they're marketing to us. It's definitely here to stay because computers have gotten fast enough and the data's, you know, we've been able to collect enough of the data to make it most effective. It's going to impact our medical, and there's no way it's not going to impact our battlefield, right? It absolutely will. The challenges we have is we really need to smartly think through this. And we are, as a military, trying to be extremely proactive in the ethical aspect of it and being transparent, because some of the challenges that you have with some of the AI algorithms is if you created an AI algorithm today that is for a finance system, and it's going to help people get paid more effectively and pinpoint where there's problems with finance, for instance, you could turn that AI algorithm with other data around a few weeks later, and it could be used in combat. And so when you think of the way the algorithms needed to be developed and how we need to approach it, we have got to be extremely careful because it's important that we do it. It's an absolute imperative that we do it, that we bring AI into our systems, into our society effectively. But we have got to be careful how we do it because it's a very easy switch from a good and happy AI system to a nefarious AI system, right? And so that's what we need to be careful on. Now, with regard to the battlefield, like absolutely. I mean, we are going to need AI to counter certain threats that are powered by AI, right? That's going to be out there. And so how are we going to effectively do that? We need to, I think, come together as a society and understand the benefits, the value. Like there's so much value in it. It's not general AI. It's not going to, general AI means like a conscious computer system that's going to take over the world, like a, you know, a Skynet or the Matrix. It's not that. It may never be that. We're way far away from that. So we need to understand that we have to implement it now. We have to work together with academia. We have to work together with industry. And we need to transparently develop the capability and figure out how to most effectively implement it into the, you know, the battlefield.
Now, who owns that process? Like, who do you think is that rest on the shoulders and responsibility of everyone? That's a deep question, I think, but I mean, it's a big question.
It is. It's a big question. And I think we all need to take responsibility to owning that answer. There are entities in the DOD, like the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center, that is feverishly working on some of those aspects of it, right? And that's really important, but it can't just be that center. It can't just be the budget we have. Like I don't run the budget and I know there's a lot of complications. So I wouldn't venture to say that they're doing it wrong. I'm not saying that at all, but I definitely know that it takes a lot of investment too, in order to effectively bring about this technology in an ethical way. So we need to have a lot of people engaged, and we need people to understand the role as a society, like as an American society. Man, I love America, right? And we're different. We're disparate. Of course, we come from disparate backgrounds, and there's a lot of different opinions, and there's some challenges. I mean, some real challenges that we're facing, of course, as a society that is playing out, you know, on social media and on media and in our neighborhoods. But like, we have got to figure out a way to come together and recognize that we are in this together, and there are some serious threats. And the only way for us to solve it is to trying to unite behind a voice of, you know, ethical development and implementation in our systems, and hold people to account, right? Hold not just, and I'm not talking about like other nations, that could be a piece of it, but I'm talking about like our big tech companies and our government. We need to hold each other to account, but work together in order to see that future.
Absolutely. And I know it's a complex problem. Well, sir, as we wrap up the podcast, I like to ask my guest, if you found 15-year-old Cinco in the street, is there any advice you would give him?
No, I wouldn't give him any advice. Not per se, I guess. What I would love to share with myself when I were younger is, and with other listeners, you know, maybe in this part of their life is, you know, I firmly believe things happen for a reason. And I think that there's going to be so many failures. Like, that's what I would want to tell myself is like, dude, you are going to fall on your face so many times, right? Like, you're going to do things that you regret. You're going to say things that you regret. You're going to make decisions that are just horrible decisions, right? Like, you know, you're going to fail. You're going to take tests that you prepared for, and you're going to get crushed by it. You're going to have like these things happen to your career that you did not expect, that you did not want to have happen. And you're going to think that certain pathways are totally closed to you because of what is happening. And they may be, but the point is like, dude, it is all right. Like, it's not all right to like stay down, right? When you get knocked down, it's not all right to stay down. You have a responsibility to get up and know that what is being formed in you is something much greater than that failure in that moment, right? Like, if you want to develop character, if you want to develop virtue, you need discipline, and you need to understand that when those things go wrong that you either had control of or didn't have control of, regardless, that there is something out there for you to learn from those experiences and to pick yourself back up and keep moving, to live that fulfilled life, right? And that's because I've had so many failures and things that didn't go the way that I expected or planned, I just would want to remind myself in those nights, in those moments, you know, with tears or with sorrow or with anger, with fear, frustration, whatever it is, like, there is a tomorrow and there is something to gain from that experience, to pick yourself back up from, to move on towards. Even though it's confusing at times where to go, you gotta get moving.
That's perfect. And I love wrapping up the podcast, and that's some sage advice. Colonel Hamilton, I really appreciate your time. I know people are really gonna enjoy hearing your story in aviation and everything that you've been doing and have done up to this point.
Awesome. No, Rain, thanks so much for having me. It's fantastic to be able to connect with other aviators and to be able to share my stories with you know, aviation enthusiasts and other listeners out there, because we all have stories and they're great to share. And I appreciate the ability, the platform that you've provided me to be able to share those.
Oh, thank you, sir. And again, best of luck in the future, and hopefully our paths cross soon.
Yeah, all my best, Rain.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Colonel Hamilton. Again, I'd like to thank all my Patreon supporters, as well as those who've gone over to iTunes and left a rating review. Again, all that is tremendously helpful to the podcast. We'll see you back here in 2 weeks.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, Our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.